In the first place, I represented a party. I was the only member. I didn't have anyone to second my motions if I wanted to put forward a motion in the council. I didn't know the procedure. I'm always very bad about those things, and I had to study the procedure of the council in order to find out how you could utilise the council rules in order to get over what you wanted to say. For instance, the first session that I attended at the council, one of the conservative reactionary people got up and made a very, very strong attack on me personally, on my whole election campaign and what I stood for and everything. And when I wanted to get up to reply, I couldn't do it. And if it hadn't have been for one member of the Labour Party who was friendly towards me, the others were hostile, I wouldn't have learnt, because the council rules were very, very difficult. How to utilise the council rules in order to be able to reply to things like that at a different stage, and how you use them.
They weren't going to teach you.
They were not going to teach me, no. But this man, he was the one who helped me. Mm-hmm. And later on, and all that, well, let's not talk about the council, such a bore.
Yes. A question related to that. Were you the only woman on the council?
No, when I got into the council, there had been two elderly ladies. They were like something out of Victoriana, who wore sort of long black dresses and hats and so on. I think there was one of them left on the council, but she was no longer on the council. Was she still on when I got elected? There might have been just one other. Then a Labour Party woman, Jessie MacPherson, was elected to the Johannesburg Council.
Did she become mayor, right?
Yes, she became mayor. Mm. And later on, another woman, Joyce, what was her name?
Waring.
Joyce Waring, very reactionary. Frank Waring was a member of Parliament, reactionary member of Parliament. But they'd never had a young woman. Now, we're talking about, 45 years ago, something, yes.
Would it be in the mid-40s, isn't it?
That's right. I was elected in 43. I was on the council from 43 to 46. So, you see, I was young then. It was a long time ago.
It was a surprise to them.
It was a surprise.
Your political position and the fact you're a woman, it must have been difficult.
I utilised the fact that I was a woman shamelessly, and the fact, during the election. I campaigned. We held street corner meetings and meetings in boarding houses. There were a lot of boarding houses in Hillbrow where I stood. And I used to go around with Michael Harmel from between 6 and 8 in the evening. We'd go to the proprietor and say, "May we speak to your people?" And we had a sitting audience in the dining rooms. We'd just enter the dining room. We'd say we are talking about the municipal elections and this is the candidate. Michael used to say, "This is the candidate of the Communist Party, Hilda Watts," and sort of, we sort of brushed over that. I mean, I did stand as a communist. And then I'd get up and make a blatant speech playing on the fact that there were no women in the city council and so on and so on. In those days, nobody thought that women had a point of view that was different from men, because this whole idea, feminist idea, that women need to be represented not only for the political views that they represent, but also because they are women and they have a different outlook upon life to men. That didn't exist, but I put it over all the same. And then when we'd finished with the boarding houses, we'd go and hold about 5 or 6 street corner meetings with a loudspeaker, just, and people come out on their flat balconies and so on.
Mm. And so you must have picked up the woman's vote as well.
I hope so. I don't know. Well, these were a series of coincidences. I don't know what the fluke was. The fluke was getting on at all.
Then in 46 you were arrested, is that right?
Oh, yes, in the mine strike.
Yes, after the mine strike, yes.
Yes. I was still on the council then at that time.
That also must have been a surprise for the council to have one of its councillors arrested for.
Yes.
For a non-fraudulent offence. Yes. I think they were accustomed to having councillors arrested for fraud, corruption, and general skullduggery.
They did awful things to me on the council. You see, being naive, you have to know how these things work. You go into Parliament and bodies like that, you really should study beforehand, and I hadn't. Every member of the council had to be on one of the subcommittees by council rules. So they put me on the Parks, Gardens and Estates Subcommittee. That's right. However, Members of the council had the right to attend, though not to vote, at all the other subcommittees. So I made it my duty, particularly to attend what was then called non-European affairs. I regarded myself as the non-European representative on the non-European affairs committee, and also other committees that I was interested in. Subsequently, I was put onto the following year or the last year onto a committee that dealt with public health, and went around looking. I was put on a thing called a slums court, and I didn't realise I was absolute pawn. The whole thing was so corrupt. They, at the end of the war, they had restrictions on building, and to get a building permit, you had to get a special permit from the council. And what some ways in which it was done was, if a property was declared a slum property, it could be pulled down, and you'd be able to put up a new building there. And so they had the slums court that used to go around, and members of the slums court, not me, but the other members, were primed that this building should be declared a slum. I mean, if you think about the number of slums that exist in any city, it's almost arbitrary choice to decide one's a slum and one's not. But if the landlord of that particular building has been on to one of the council members, and so on and so on, and I used to go around and look at these slums and agree that, yes, that's a pretty awful building, should come down. But one day a young Indian lad came to see me, and he told me that his boss wants to get a building permit and has arranged with one of the councillors on the slums court. Yeah, and after that I just resigned from the slums court, because it was impossible for me to tell which was genuine, which was not. But it was that kind of thing. But however, it gave me access to the townships in a way that I hadn't had before. They couldn't. The man in charge of non-European affairs, the council official, was a very vicious man. The African name for him, I don't know what it was in vernacular, but in English it was the angry fox, and that's what he was like. And he tried his best to keep me away. It was the time the squatters' movement blew up, and there was so much going on there.
Panzer's movement.
That's right, yes. And I had access to the townships and to people in the townships and so on, and to discussions on the committees about what they were doing about the squatters' movement.
Then why were you voted off or chucked off?
Yeah, well, they passed a new delimitation. They changed my area specifically to get me off.
African practice,
They included in it a really reactionary white suburb and chopped off an area that were my supporters. I did stand again, but there really was no chance of getting back again. And this was a new delimitation which was designed simply to get me off the council. I wasn't sorry. I was not happy.
In the council?
Yes.
You were, of course, the second communist on the council. The council was taken over in the 1930s, or was it in the earlier, during a bus strike, when a group of International Socialist League, or something,
took over? 1920s sometime. Yes, when they took over and formed the Johannesburg Soviet
during a
tramway or bus driver's strike. I can't remember who was. It would have been Dryburgh. Was it Dryburgh or somebody like that?
Extraordinary incident.
Yeah.
The council chambers were taken over.
That's right. They took over the council chambers and decided they'd continue to run the trams and collect the funds from the public, which they would, I can't remember, use them for the union or distribute to the population or something.
They never have capitulated.
They were running a Soviet. Yes.
I thought I was the first white, the only white to be elected by a white, the only communist to be elected
by a white. There were a couple in Cape Town.
Yes, but not by a white vote, whites only vote.
No, that's true, yes, coloured vote, yes.
Yeah, tell me one more.
You know, I'd love another cup of tea.
There's plenty of tea here.
Thank you.
I'll be very strong by this time.
How involved was the party in the 46 strike?
Very
much.
Because the state seemed to try to prove they were, and then didn't manage. But
they didn't manage because the state tried to prove it the wrong way. I mean, the truth of the matter was that there was a big party involvement in the mine workers' union, because the people really who who started the Mine Workers Union, included J.B. Marx, who was a member of the Communists. He was the president of the Mine Workers Union. Elie Weinberg was some sort of a trade union advisor or consultant to the union. Several of the union organizers were members of the party, so to say, although the party didn't run the union, the party had an enormous, I mean, party people had a really big influence in the union. And likewise, because a lot of senior sort of party people like J.B. Marx and others were in the union, when the strike started, or the strike was beginning to happen, they started pulling in active people they knew they could rely on to do various operations and so on, and they pulled in a lot of party people to assist in the strike, in the running of the strike and so on. So the party did have a considerable involvement in the strike.
Were you on propaganda?
I was on propaganda. I mean, that strike, if you look at that, if you find that strike bulletin, if it still exists, they produced a sort of daily...
I've seen it.
Nightly it was, in fact. It was produced between the hours of about 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. the next morning.
Distributed between the hours of 3 and 4.
Whatever time they changed shift, and when the night shift changed... I think the shift changed from between two and four or something in the morning. And the way to get to the miners was to get out to the mine properties when the miners were coming, were moving either from the shaft to the compound or from the compound to the shaft in the changing of the shift in dead of night, and having to cross bits of open felt, you see, where they couldn't easily be supervised.
Yeah.
And every night our people were going out just taking this daily strike bulletin and trying to distribute it to the still working miners who were, and of course our people were being arrested every night, and I was running the strike bulletin for them, or producing it. I don't remember who wrote it.
Were you still working full time for, or did you have another job?
No, by this
you
time...
You weren't working for the party when you came back?
No, after I came back from the army, no. I didn't go to work for the party again. I went back to my job. So I had a full-time job. I used to work practically all night on this bulletin, sort of finish at about 5 o'clock in the morning, collapse on a settee somewhere, sleep an hour, go into a hairdresser's and get myself a shave, and go to work a whole week. It was the most exhausting week of my life.
It was a very exciting week.
But it was very stimulating.
Yeah.
And I worked for a firm. I'd been with them for quite a number of years and went off, and I was on a good terms with them, so if I didn't turn up, if there was a meeting during the day of the district committee or something that I had to attend, I just didn't arrive at work during that week, and they sort of closed their eyes to it, so I was able to devote quite a lot of time to the thing.
So you put up on trial? Or
yes, what happened was after the strike, a lot of our members were arrested during the course of this distribution. Anybody who was found with leaflets in or around the mine property or anywhere like that during the night were arrested and charged. So we had a lot of people who were arrested doing that. But then immediately after the strike, or during the strike, I think they actually staged some police raids on the party office and the mine workers union office and other places. And on the strength of that, immediately after the strike, they arrested the entire Johannesburg District Committee of the party, of which we were both members, which is how we came to be arrested. And they charged the whole district committee and all these people who had been caught distributing leaflets and the officials of the Mine Workers Union and so on, originally with conspiracy to commit sedition. That was the original charge.
Which was a severe charge.
Yeah. And then subsequently it was dropped when they saw that the case couldn't be established. I mean, the case was dragging on and it wasn't getting anywhere. And they did a deal with the defence that if we pleaded guilty to assisting an illegal strike, they'd drop
the sedition charge, and that we'd get suspended sentences, we wouldn't go to jail. Well, we had a long debate about the rights and wrongs of it, and in the end the majority decided on it, but it was a very, very bad decision. It should never have been done.
So in fact, the committee... people plead guilty and...
That's right.
Everybody pleaded guilty.
It was wrong.
People who had... I mean, there were people like Braunfischer had been on
holiday
during the whole period of that mine strike. He hadn't participated at all. He pleaded guilty. Dodd, who had been in jail in Ladysmith or somewhere during the whole period on some passive resistance charge that he was involved in.
There were over 50 of us. Yes. And one of the advocates who made this deal, Vernon Beranger, who was a terrifying man to be on the wrong side of, when we had a discussion about whether or not to accept this, one of the Africans got up and said, but he hadn't assisted in the illegal strike, and Vernon pinned him with his icy cold blue eye and said, well, why didn't you assist in the strike? And the bloke just collapsed and crumbled, you see. But it was politically, it was a very bad decision, and it taught us a lesson never to do such a thing again.
Mm-hmm. Which is was well done. Yeah. Wasn't Berenger involved in Ravenna?
Yes, he was. He was a fearsome.
He was a scourge of policemen. He was one of these chaps who really delighted in pulling the wings off policemen. You know, it was his greatest joy in life. He was a sort of natural anti-policeman, and
he also had a very close relationship with the police force, because many of his cases were criminal cases.
Yeah.
Mm. In which he and the police had various arrangements.
He wasn't
and so
essentially
on.
A political man, was he?
No, not really.
He was political in his ideas.
He got involved in the Springbok Legion somehow. He wasn't in the army, but somehow they formed a thing during the war, the Springbok Legion, called something called the Home Front League. I can't remember why. It was some sort of a auxiliary body, perhaps because soldiers weren't supposed to make public political propaganda, so they used to do it through this Home Front League. And he got involved in this and so on. And he had political views. I mean, he was sort of...
Yes, he was left-wing. He was radical
political
in his views.
Views. But he wasn't really a political figure at all.
Am I asking you too many questions?
No. Will you get to the meat of what you want to know? That's the question.
It is. This is what I'm talking about. You see, I need to know the context within which the newspapers operated, and also the context in which the people... I mean, what telling me about your propaganda is precisely about media, and it's about publication.
Yeah.
So I'm not. If I end up this chatting to you, and you still don't know that I've got to the meat, then it's a successful interview.
Right.
But the party was banned in 50. Why did it agree to disband? Surely they'd learnt not to acquiesce. You said they'd learnt in this.
Well, I'll tell you why. I wasn't on the Central Committee. I didn't take part in this decision. But I'll tell you why the membership, like myself, agreed. Because we thought it was a ploy.
Yeah.
By the party.
By the Central Committee.
You see, if the party didn't disband, then every person who had been a member of the party was liable to immediate...
Or so the lawyers said.
So the lawyers
even told
us, yes.
That story
to be arrested, to immediate arrest. And we thought that what they intended was officially above ground to say the party has been dissolved, whereas actually it would continue. And we all waited.
It didn't, did it? The ones who took the decision
on the Central Committee
intended
that it should be disbanded. Yeah. And we waited to be contacted, to be told you're appointed to such and such a group and you're going to work with so and so. We sort of innocent, naive or stupid members of the party. This was why we had a meeting in Johannesburg when it was discussed, and we all thought this is nothing but a way of ensuring that we're not all going to be arrested immediately. That's all.
Really, yeah. Because I have the sense that the new party that started up in the late 1930s was a new kind of party. It lasted until 1950, and then one gets a sense that when the party finally re-emerges underground, it's a completely new thing again.
It was.
Almost different people, or not different people, but a much pruned down, smaller...
Well, it had to be, because so many of the others had agreed, genuinely agreed, to the dissolution of the party. People like Jack Simons, for instance.
Who were the people who really wanted the party to disband in 50?
Well, I mean, basically the Central Committee consisted of mainly half of it were Cape Townians, or more than half. And there were a couple of Johannesburg people, a couple of Natal people, and so on. But basically, it was a Cape Town, because the executive, which consisted something like half of the Central Committee, was Cape Town based.
What had happened over
a period was that, in fact, sort of political tendencies had developed, which began to separate to some extent. I mean, it's too simple to say the Transvaal from from the Cape, but it did in fact represent some sort of a provincial difference which began to develop, and it was related to the significance to be attached to the National Liberation Movement.
Mm.
And in the period leading up to 1950, in the 40s and through that period, there began to develop differences of emphasis in which the Transvaal, where the national movement was reviving and becoming an important factor, and Natal, where the national movement was strong, began to adjust the party's view of the significance of the National Liberation Movement, to place the National Liberation Movement much more in the forefront than it had done than the party had done in the 30s. In Cape Town, where the National Movement was really not significant in that way, the same emphasis did not exist, and there began to be the emphasis on the party as the leading element in the whole struggle, and the National Liberation Movement to be somewhat insignificant. So this sort of political difference began to show itself. And I think to some extent the decision to dissolve the party reflected that, and it also reflected another thing, and that is we've had a long period of legality and we've got used to being legal.
Didn't know how to operate.
Yes, and I mean we'd forgotten, although we talked vaguely about the underground and so on, nobody really knew how to do it. And a lot of people had developed a lifestyle where they weren't even prepared to contemplate doing it if it came to that. So that when the crunch came, all these factors came together, people saying, well, look here, I mean, if the party's made illegal, then the whole movement collapses, and there's no proposition, there's no way in which you can run a national struggle on an underground basis in this country with our type of people, without sort of background and so on. They convinced themselves that there was no future for the party in these new conditions. So the majority of the Central Committee, bulldozed to some extent, I think, by this legal opinion, which I've never accepted and don't even to this day, went along with this idea of dissolving the party. And there was only a tiny minority on the Central Committee who voted against it.
But one of the most influential people on the Central Committee was Moses Katani, and Moses Katani was in favour of the dissolution of the party.
Mm-hmm. Well, he subsequently denied it, but he didn't vote against it at that meeting. I wasn't at the meeting, so I can't tell you what he said or how he spoke.
I remember from what people said.
He didn't vote against it, that's for sure.
Not only that he didn't vote against it, but that he was strongly in favour of it. And
well, I don't know.
Because he was a kind of senior African in the party, the most influential person, I'm sure that his view carried a lot of weight.
Yes, I'm sure it did, but I think, you know, everybody to some extent was unprepared for that debate at the Central Committee. They hadn't had time to really think through a position before they got there, and so when a suggestion was put up that they take the party underground, I mean, it sounded like sort of fantasy, you know, it's unthinkable, these sort of people we've got without experience and background, we can't do it, everybody's on the police list, the police know all our names and addresses and nicknames and habits and everything else. I mean, you can't just disappear into the underground with a body like this. So I think to some extent they got bulldozed into it, and they took the decision, and I think the majority of the rank and file, certainly in the Transvaal,
without a doubt,
didn't believe that the thing was serious. I mean, that's why at a general meeting in Johannesburg, where this decision was explained to us by Katani,
we hardly discussed it.
Nobody opposed it.
Yeah.
There was no opposition.
Which is probably so unthinkable that the party
People didn't think it was serious. They thought this is a con job. We're going to con the government into thinking we're doing something which we're not doing.
And at this open meeting, where there's probably an informer anyway, we're going to show we're dissolving the party. Ha ha ha.
And then everybody waited, thinking, well, now.
And we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and it didn't happen.
It must have been a very strange time.
It was a strange time.
And there were mass demonstrations against the Bull Act.
Well, you see, this was part of the background, too, because we had concentrated so much on a campaign to oppose the Bill and to try and frustrate the Bill. We didn't really concentrate our attention on what was going to happen after the thing became law. We almost talked ourselves into thinking we could stop it. So, you know, to some extent, when it happened that the thing passed, we weren't prepared for it.
Mm.
And that goes to the Central Committee like everybody else.
Yeah. But now, during the 1940s, the party had been so central in building the ANC. I mean, is that right? Because one gets the sense that it
had been closely associated with it. I think the key influence in building the ANC up really had been the Youth League and their action programme. And this was, although there were party people like Attani and Marx and others cooperating and involved in it, these were really not communist, most of them, the Youth League people, Sisulu and Tambo and Mandela. At one stage, some of them were anti-communist, not all of them. But they certainly weren't communists on the whole. There were a few sort of older veteran communists like Attani and Marx of considerable standing in the ANC who went along with them because they were pursuing the militant. They were the militants as against the sort of reformist leadership of the ANC. So the communists went along with the militants. But I don't think you could say that the party built up the ANC in that period. I think the Youth League sponsored it. The party lent its weight to it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the ranks of the party, we had some African members who just wouldn't know. They didn't want to know. They didn't want to know about joining the ANC. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't join it. They thought the ANC is a lot of reformist bourgeois nonsense. That's not for us. We're revolutionaries. And we used to struggle with a lot of our African members to try and persuade them that the ANC was something they should be in and active in.
Of course, there was a period when the ANC was very revisionist.
Yes, true, but they didn't see the sort of... They couldn't see the prognosis for the future. They couldn't see what the potentialities were of this thing. And they just took this attitude that that's not for us. We're revolutionaries and we're not going into that body. Quite a lot of them.
Mm. But all these people in the party who suddenly found they had no party, what happened? Did it not just peel off and disappear? Or how did it reform? Was COD the thing that pulled them back in?
No.
I mean, it happened... When the party was dissolved, a lot of our members were already in either the trade unions or the national movements, the Indian Congress, the African Congress, Coloured People's Organisations and the Cape and so on. So the majority of our members, I would say, leaving aside the whites for a moment, the majority of our members were involved in mass organisations of one sort or another. And they carried on that involvement. In fact, they transferred their party political activity into the activity of their local ANC or Indian Congress branch. As far as the whites were concerned, it was a bit more difficult, but then amongst the whites, there were different groups. There were people who'd been, for instance, in the Springbok Legion and involved in organisations like that. COD was formed shortly, or I don't know, within a year or two years later. So people carried on various... I think I'm probably right in saying the school education thing, not the night schools, but the alternative education thing was starting about that time. Quite a lot of our people were involved in building up alternative schools and so on. There was activity, the Western Areas Removal Campaign, a big ad hoc committee was formed in which quite a lot of our white members were involved one way or another and so on. So there were field for activity. One didn't feel that it was a complete stop, you see. It didn't feel like that. But a lot of people, of course, it was an opportunity
to bail out.
I don't know, perhaps that's putting it too harshly, but they didn't find an immediate niche for themselves, so they stopped activity, and then they found that perhaps it wasn't very easy to get back in. It was more comfortable or safer or whatever it was being out, and they stayed out. So a lot
you
of
get
people
tired
did drop
sometimes.
Out. Yes, a lot of people did
yes,
drop
did
out
drop
in
out.
That period.
But then, after a while, when we weren't approached and nothing happened, people tentatively began to speak to others, and little sort of groups began forming. And it was at that time that some people in Johannesburg decided, well, it's going to be dangerous. Everybody's going to be forming little sort of communist party groups and things. We'd better get together and establish a proper party.
So when was the party re-established? 52 or 53?
Well, I don't know.
I suppose it was
50,
a couple of years
probably
before.
Probably 51 or two, I
yeah,
would
think. Yeah, I think it was about 2 years.
I think it's probably less than 2 years. I mean, it already, a sort of leadership group started getting together and consulting all around the country with a view to making soundings and seeing whether the basis existed for forming a new party. And that would have started fairly soon after the, you know, by 51 was certainly in existence. So the beginnings of an organisation were there. And eventually there was a first national conference called, I'm not too good on dates, I think probably 51, 52.
You're lousy on dates.
I can't remember the years, but I'm usually 5 years out. But round about 51 or 52, I think, the first national conference of Delhi, you know, of sort of small delegations from the various places came together and formally resolved to found a party. And having done it in the dark and in the underground, no announcement, it was decided that no announcement would be made of this fact, that the party would just go ahead and start reorganizing, building up its organization and so on. And that carried on for some years. In fact, the first announcement formally that the party had been reconstituted was made during the state of emergency in 1960. Up to that time, there had been agreement not to formally announce the existence of the party, because to have done so would have, I mean, there were various arguments. There were disagreements about whether it was correct or not correct to do that. But basically, the main consideration for those who decided not to announce the existence of the party was that by that time, the majority of the party members who formed the new party were involved in legal political organizations. And to announce the reconstitution of the party would both prejudice their own position, perhaps, in those organisations, because after all, we were all known. Everybody knew who the ex-communists were, even if they didn't know who the new communists were. It would have prejudiced our own position, and it would also have prejudiced the organisations in which a lot of our people held leading, legal organisations in which they held leading posts. So, until 1960, during the midst of the state of emergency, there was never an announcement that the party had been reformed.
Who was that leadership that started getting together?
There were mainly people from the Central Committee who were in the Transvaal. I mean, it was a Transvaal group. I don't think its membership has ever been disclosed, and I don't know whether it should be at this point or not. I don't think there's never been any recognition of its membership, but the bulk of them were people either from the district committee or the central committee from the Transvaal who started it, and then they did this canvass round the country and so on.
So could one sort of generally say that the new party formed around the Johannesburg branch came out of that?
It came out of the old party without any doubt, but even before the party was dissolved in 1950, from about 1946 onwards, there had been insistent pressure from the Transvaal for the Central Committee to be returned to the Transvaal, which was where it obviously should have been. I mean, it was the centre of the country politically, and it should have been then. It was only really this hangover from the past, the fear that the same sort of faction fighting and disruption might start again, and the fact that some of the members of the Central Committee who were considered key people weren't prepared to move to the Transvaal, prevented that happening. But there'd been consistent pressure, and when the Central Committee, the Cape Central Committee, dissolved the party, I think the reconstitution took place from the leadership of the old party, but with its Transvaal base rather than the Cape base.
Where did Ruth fit in all this?
Well, Ruth was a member of the Johannesburg District Committee. Ruth and Joe Slovo were both members, but they were young. I mean, after all, they were both still in the youth movement when they were still in whatever it was, the student movement or the Young Communist League or something, when the party was dissolved. Yeah. Joe, I think, was still at university. I'm not sure if Ruth wasn't still at university.
Ruth was 42, 43, 40, up to about 46.
She wasn't at university. And Joe had been home from the war for 4 or 5 years.
Well, Joe only went to university after he came back.
Yes, I know, but he didn't go.
He was still at university for sure when the party was dissolved. That I'm absolutely certain of, because they formed a student, sort of Marxist student or communist student group at the university at that time. But they were both really young. I mean, they were on the sort of youth level. She was on the district committee, so was Joe. But they weren't by any means the sort of leading echelon, that was an older generation already.
But they were very active. Ruth was an extremely active person once. Whatever she did, she was.
In 40, fate she was writing for the New Age.
Yeah.
And as far as I can work out, pardon me, she was writing something like 16 articles a week, which is a phenomenal output.
Well, that's quite possible.
That's right. I don't know. I don't remember her as being a very prolific writer. I think she was a very good
news hound.
You know, she got the news, and she also was a good organizer. She got other people to organize and write. But I don't remember her as being a very prolific writer, but that's my own.
Not necessarily big stories, but...
But quite, yes.
Oh, well,
that probably is so.
She was full-time. I mean, she was a full-time
She was working full-time.
Yes.
She was very quick at everything, always, all her life.
Yes.
And she built up a network of people who came to her with information. And once somebody came to her with a story, she'd go out after it. She was a fantastic news hound. And one of the things, I don't know if you know, that this whole story of the slave labour on the Bethel farms was her story, not Michael Scott's story, but he was attributed to having that story. What happened was one of the labourers came to her and told her about what the conditions were like.
I thought it came to Drum first.
It was to Ruth. Ruth was the originator of this whole investigation. And she decided to take an African who was in the office, can't remember what it was.
Carby.
Oh, was it Carby?
Yes.
And she also roped in Michael Scott because she thought this is going to help us and give it a respectable air, you know, having a bit of church cloth there with it. And because The Guardian was a weekly paper, Michael Scott was able to break the story to the Rand Daily Mail, which was a daily paper, and it became Michael Scott's story, but it wasn't, it was Ruth's.
She met Kurt Savander.
That's right.
Yes.
He died recently.
Yes, the Lion of the North.
Yes,
he was one of the people who really took her around in that area and showed her all about. Joe Carby was he was working for New Age, he was the photographer, I think, and went with her on these trips and presumably did a lot of interpreting and so on for her. I don't know. Also, he was killed in Zimbabwe a few years ago. He was assassinated, yes, he was in the ANC office.
That's right, yes.
And he was associated with her. That was one of his first sort of reporting jobs on that Bethel farm thing.
What was the role of New Age? How does it seem to be? Is it still independent? I mean, of the party, or was it drawn more?
No, it was independent.
I think it was generally regarded as being the voice of the party. I don't know, as I say, I don't know.
But it wasn't controlled by the party. The party didn't say you shouldn't have this particular article.
You know,
party people tended to run it.
Because we were the most active people. It started with Betty Radford and her husband, you see. And at that stage, I don't know if they were in the party when they started the paper. Subsequently, they were in the party, and to some extent, I don't know what sort of overall control the party in Cape Town exercised over The Guardian. But it certainly ran as an independent paper. As far as the transfer was concerned, the party exercised no control at all over the Guardian. What the party did was it regarded it as its voice. So the party people were were active and energetic in selling the paper. We were all out selling it every week and so on. So it was our voice, but it wasn't our paper in that sense. We didn't control it. I don't think Ruth was subject to any sort of control or authority of the party in any of the stories she followed. She
just went out and got
was dependent on the Cape Town New Age office. Now, whether they in turn were being lent on by the party or reporting back daily or weekly to the party, I don't know. I don't think so, but...
This is in the 1950s or 40s.
I don't know that there was that sort of link. Brian Bunting or Fred Garnison, who worked there, could tell you what the Cape Town link was. But, I mean, basically, as officially and in practice in the Transvaal, the Guardian was our sort of voice, but not our property.
You were both on Congress of Democrats, weren't you?
I was never a member of the Congress of Democrats.
I had been banned.
Yeah. Cheryl Walker put me down in her book as I was never in the Congress of Democrats.
I was on its executive. In fact, I was one of the founders of it, and on its national executive. when we, until I, well, until I was banned, until after I was...
When were you banned?
I don't know, I can't remember, but I carried, I mean, you know, it, because it wasn't a relevant date, rather than banning only meant that you publicly ceased, you didn't privately cease, so I can't really tell you when...
The pseudonyms.
Well,
yes, that's right,
and you did things underground and so on, I mean... One didn't take these bans too seriously, well, except the public side of it. One couldn't go to a public meeting. I mean, I know I was banned at the time of the Congress of the People because I couldn't attend. But when I was banned exactly, I don't know. You know, quite possibly I was banned before ever the CRP was thought of. But that didn't stop me participating in all of it, you see, because that was a private activity. You know, the public activity stopped.
Do you remember of the committee sent up to direct the development of the Congress of the People?
Yeah.
You used to meet in Yusuf Kachalia's house often.
Well, we used to meet in the Transvaal. I mean, what happened was there was a joint meeting of the Congresses held in Natal, which just took the decision to convene the Congress of the People. And they set up a, I can't remember, a working committee, a working group, I don't know what they called it, which was to be in the Transvaal. And I was a member of that, Oliver Tambo, probably Yusuf, I can't remember the other, almost certainly Yusuf Kachalia, I think, but I can't say for sure. So there was a sort of working group, and I was part of that, because I'd been at the joint meeting which took the decision. And so I was on the organising side of it all the way through, although I couldn't actually show my face there. Yeah. So.
But what I'm interested in is the one committee that was set up to handle the charter itself.
Ah, yes, well, that was now a working group or a subcommittee of the working subcommittee. It was a drafting commission of sorts, I suppose is the best thing. It was a drafting commission. I was a member of that.
Do you remember who else was on that?
No, I don't. You know, people have asked me, and I really don't. I can't recall who else was on it at all. So this is where my mind's a blank.
Walter was Sisulu, I think, or Drew.
Could well have been. Could have been. I just cannot recall who was on that drafting commission.
And then you wrote the call as part of the call for volunteers.
I wrote the call as part of this working group that was the subcommittee that was set up, including in that book of
Cronin's
and Sutner's, the book about the COP. They've got a couple of circulars about volunteers and so on. I either wrote them or wrote most of those circulars, and I also wrote the call. The call was definitely my own work. It wasn't a committee job.
How did you get to write the call? It's an extraordinary bit of political poetry. Did you just sit down and write it, or were there influences?
Well, I mean, it was a bit of an inspirational time, you know. I mean, the whole business of the decision to form the COP was really very, in a way, it was very dramatic, although it's not presented that way in the history books, because the history books have got it wrong, I'm afraid. And I'm dedicating myself these days to trying to put it right. What the history books tell you is that Professor Matthews proposed the convening of the COP and the Freedom Charter, which is not true. What Professor Matthews proposed was something slightly different. And what happened was this meeting of the Joint Congress Committees was held in Natal, in somewhere like Tongaat, where, because Chief Lutuli was then under restriction and couldn't leave the area, and he presided at this meeting. I can't remember, it was the whole of the joint executives or X numbers from each of the five Congress bodies that existed at that time. And the issue before us was, what are we going to do now? The defiance campaign is finished, you know, there'd been some talk of an anti-pass campaign, it hadn't got off the ground and so on, and we were really at a sort of impasse. So the discussion was on what is the movement going to do next. And the usual sort of propositions came up from various people, a petition, an anti-pass campaign, a work towards mass demonstrations and this sort of thing. You see, nothing very imaginative. And then Matthews came up with a suggestion which, looking back on it, I think was probably one of the most revolutionary proposals ever put before the South African political movement. And what he said was, he said, look here, why don't we spend a year or two drawing up a voters' roll of the entire population, the black population who are not on the voters' roll. We go out and canvass house to house, draw up a voters' roll, and then convene a constituent assembly of the whole population, black and white.
In other words, have a general election.
I mean, virtually, that was his proposal.
Yeah.
Well, when they set up a resolution subcommittee or something to consider all the various proposals that had been made. Now, coming from a professor of law, that proposal really was, I think, if you take it seriously, that this constituent assembly, he didn't describe what it would do, but a constituent assembly presumably would draw up a new South African constitution or something. That really was seditious. And he was a professor of law, so I can only assume that he made it deliberately provocative and to shake people's thinking, I think. I don't know what was in his mind. But when this resolutions committee went away and considered the thing, we all said, look here, this is fantasy. And I mean, we haven't got the resources, the capacity, the membership, the organisational skills to do anything like this. This is way ahead of anything we can think of. So we watered down his proposal to the holding of a big Congress of the People, so it wouldn't be on a sort of formal voters' roll constituency registration basis, out of which would come not a new constitution, but a vision of the future of Freedom Charter. So it wasn't quite what he proposed, but he sponsored the... I don't want to take it away from him. I think he fired the spark, you see. And from this came this decision to convene the Congress of the People. And I think what's not understood by most people is that in the forefront of our minds at that time was not the Freedom Charter. That wasn't the big thing. That was the spin-off. The big thing was going to be going out and consulting people and saying to them, look here, what do you want of the future? This was the central aim of the campaign. The Freedom Charter was a byproduct.
When we were back home.
That's right. I saw that somebody wrote an article about the when we's that I was reading recently.
Yes, when we were.
I can't remember.
There was a wonderful little play about Rhodesians on the radio, on the television. I can't remember the name of the man who wrote it.
Something Road. It was Salisbury Road.
Salisbury Road, I think. That's right. I think it was called. It was about a white Rhodesian. Left in his job when the Wimbys have gone.
Yes.
Because he's older and hasn't any really real alternative.
Mm.
And a black boss is appointed above him.
Mm.
And he and his one son has left the country. The other son was killed or something.
The son was called up for military service at the end of the play and refused to go.
He was the one who left.
Oh.
So talk away.
Put this together this morning. I wanted to get a feeling of when you were involved in the CP, so I know how far back to ask you questions. Was it before the war or during?
Yeah.
Before the war. I think Hilda probably earlier than me.
Yeah, I joined the Communist Party in 1935 in Britain. I went to South Africa about 1937. I was already a member of the Communist Party, but I had a talk to party people in London before I left. And at that time, it was the policy of the communists, the British communists, and I suppose it was reflected in South Africa, and that you could be a member of the Communist Party, a secret member, and then join other political parties like the Labour Party. And I was advised to join the Labour Party in South Africa, which is not the existing coloured Labour Party. It was a white. How white it was is a fact that a butcher named Light in Johannesburg, who stood for the Labour Party in a municipal election, his slogan was "Vote for Light and keep your city white." So
that's why you took the whole Labour group over to the Communist Party. I remember that.
So, in fact, Rusty and I met in the Labour League of Youth.
Mm.
That was our political meeting point. What happened afterwards, later on, was that the Communist Party in South Africa, rightly, I think, decided that it wasn't good to have dual membership, and you should either be a member of the party, an open member, or you should leave the party and be an open member of the Labour Party. And we were given the choice, and all of us chose to become open members of the Communist Party, leave the Labour Party, except for Alex Heppel. And he had been in the Communist Party, and he stayed on as a member of the Labour Party, but it was done properly. He severed his connections with the Communist Party. But that was, we were in the Labour League of Youth, and there were, as always, the youth branch of a political party is so much more militant and so on. And the arguments, of course, centred around what was then called the native question. The policy of the Labour Party in those days was that we will solve the native question when we come to power. So it's like with a pencil stroke, you brush the whole thing on, put the whole thing on one side. It's not an issue now. We'll see to it when we're in power, you see.
Or never.
Never, that's right.
Were you're a South African?
I was born in South Africa, yes. And in fact, I'd never been abroad when I joined the Communist Party, which was either 1938 or 39, I'm not sure which, but certainly pre-war. I can't recall exactly when it was. I'd been in the Labour League of Youth, and then I became a member of the Labour Party, and then I became a member of the Communist Party, so I moved from the sort of Labour Party to the Communist Party, not the other way around.
So you would have come into the party just as the whole Popular Front thing was... ideas were being...
Yes, I came really into the party from the... Really, I suppose, from the anti-fascist movement. I mean, my start in politics was taking part in campaigns of solidarity with the Spanish Civil War, for instance, and so on, and anti-fascist rallies that were being held at that time, that sort of thing. So I started from anti-fascism rather than from concern about the black majority and their conditions. That only came to me much later. So I moved from anti-fascism to socialist thinking, and from socialist thinking into the Communist Party and so on, and gradually my ideas about race problems developed
out of that, rather than
the other way around.
When did you finish your university?
I finished university in the middle of the war, around about 41 or 42. They curtailed our course. It was supposed to be a five-year course with a year practical at Wits. And because the year practical couldn't be organised because there weren't any jobs for trainee architects in the middle of the war, they shortened our course, and I can't recall if I graduated in 41 or early 42. I think it was mid-41.
Yeah, actually. It was before 42, I'm sure.
Yes, I think it was mid-41.
Because you were working with Wayburn when...
Oh, well, I did a part-time university course. I wasn't a full-time student, so I'd been working right through that period.
Was the Communist Youth League operating at Wits at the time, when did that start?
I would have thought in the 45, 46 period. I don't think, I mean, there might have been theoretically a young Communist League, but if there was, it was such a tiny splinter thing the party itself was a tiny little organisation in those days.
I want to tell you, when I came to South Africa, the Communist Party had just gone through this most tremendous upheaval. I didn't know anything about it. And I was immediately assailed by people from different sides, totally confused about the thing. And I'd spoken to a chap named Jimmy Shields, a British Communist member, before I left. And he said, they've been having a lot of troubles up there, but you've only got one task, build a party. And he was a real working class British, build a party. So I just sort of set out from that thing. It doesn't matter about all these fights and things. It was really impossible for somebody coming, a real greenhorn coming from another place, to understand what it had all been about. The Black Republic and the expulsion of all those people and so on.
But in a sense, you were the new generation of the party.
Yes.
The old generation was rather in tatters after that.
Absolutely.
It was in tatters. Yeah. Wasn't the Central Committee in Cape Town?
The Central Committee, when I joined anyway, had already been
moved to Cape Town in order to
try and pick up the pieces. Yes. And what was left of the old guard in Johannesburg, which included, incidentally, Willie Cock, which is why I was interested in it. Of the old generation,
who
anyway.
Who were those? I mean, who would you... SP and...
Those people were already out, you see. Yes. They'd all expelled each other and dropped out one way or another.
Glass and all those people. Trade unionists of Kalk's
Izzy generation. Wolfson, Willie Cock, and practically nobody else that had
Ronnie
participated.
Fleet. Yeah,
but they hadn't been sort of in the heart of this party dispute.
Bill Andrews was...
Bill Andrews was in Cape Town. Yeah. Moses Katani had gone to Cape Town because he couldn't stand the sort of situation in Johannesburg. Yes. And so there was virtually nobody left. Edwin Mfutsinyane, of course, but I don't think he had been in the forefront of the disputes at all. Mm. The people who were left really had been people who'd been on the fringes of the faction fighting. Mm. And to some extent, apart from Edwin, they were very much in eclipse. I mean, Kok and Wolfson's influence was very much in eclipse, and there was a new generation of people who hadn't been party to all these disputes who came into the party at that time, 38, 39.
Both whites and blacks, yes. You see, this was the period in which people like Walter and so on were beginning to arise in Johannesburg and getting into the National Liberation Movement and trailing also a lot of young people, of young blacks who were joining the Communist Party as well.
I find it amazing that they joined, you know, given the really terrible period in the 30s, the early 30s, it's extraordinary that that new generation arose at all.
Well, the new generation of whites who arose was one thing. I think they arose from various factors, mainly the international situation, the rise of fascism, the Spanish Civil War, the obvious imminence of a world war, you know, brewing up, the rise of Hitler and so on. This was the thing that largely sponsored the whites, I think, largely, not altogether. But as far as the blacks were concerned, you've got to remember that at that time the Communist Party was the only really active organisation that existed on the scene. I mean, the ANC was a shadow. Yes. It was an idea and it might have had a lot of sort of sympathy, but as an organisation it almost didn't exist.
There were things like the Council for African, Native and European, something like, and the Institute of Race Relations. They were kind of liberal in the most patronising kind of way towards the blacks. The Communist Party really was the only party which said, these are people, that's all. And it brought blacks and whites together.
The ANC was such a shadow that I can remember I was working for the party full time in, I suppose it was 1940, it might have been late in 1939, no, I think it must have been 1940. And at that time, the secretary of the Transvaal African National Congress used to come into the party office, beg us to give him 100 sheets of duplicated paper and borrow our duplicated to run off a notice calling whatever it was a provincial conference of the ANC, because that sort of an organisation couldn't even afford its own duplicated paper. So really the party was the only body, political body, that appeared on the scene. So any African who got interested in politics gravitated, I think, towards the party. And this was helped a lot by the African night schools that the party used to run, which was a very big factor in the development of the black membership of the party, in the Transvaal anyway. We used to run a number of night schools at which we were teaching people, I mean, basic literacy.
There were a lot of people involved in those night schools.
Yes,
practically all the party membership was involved one way or another, some more than others.
They were held in garages mostly.
Yes, garages.
But they seen as a main sort of arena for recruiting and developing the party.
I don't know.
And public meetings. I think we used to do a lot of soapbox meetings in townships
all over the place,
outside beer halls and compounds and so on.
Everywhere.
Yeah. Mm.
Now that's up to the war. You then joined up, did you?
Later, 43 probably or something like
that. We followed the party line.
Yes, which was out until it was in.
It was in for a week. There was a party member, this is irrelevant, wasting your time, in Pretoria, George Findlay, a very clever lawyer, who came and persuaded us that we should support the war. And the next week, when the party line from Britain was, we are not supporting the war, he came and explained to us why we shouldn't support the war.
Good lawyer.
Yeah. Yes. So we didn't support the war, you see. And then when the Soviet Union was attacked in 1941, then it was legitimate. Mm. That was when you joined up, wasn't it?
Later, because
you were
at that time, I was working full time for the party at that time.
As what? An organiser?
Well, I was really the propaganda Transvaal. I might have been even district secretary. I was district secretary for a year in Johannesburg. I can't remember what year that was. Maybe 43 or something like that.
It was before then.
Or before. But it must have been for a long time. I mean, from about 1940, I'd been working full-time really on the propaganda side for the Johannesburg District Committee. Mm. I'd been their propaganda department, which was how I got into all this business of newspapers in Kulilaco and leaflets and writing propaganda and so on. So that had been my function.
What did that entail? What did you actually do on the ground?
I can't quite remember.
To tell you. The handle of duplicating machines, mainly.
Largely, I think it was concerned with Nkululeko, the bulk. I mean, the routine of it would have been in producing Nkululeko, which became a printed journal, I don't know when, but probably 1940 or 41. Before that, it had been duplicated. And I'd been part of the technical team doing the duplicating and collating and so on, but I'd never, that I can recall, actually written anything for it. Probably not, because at that time I was still, in the Labour Party. I was a member of the Labour Party. When I came out of the Labour Party and came to work for the Communist Party, I think was about the time that the decision was taken to print Nkululeko, which was quite a big step. And then as it grew, we turned it into, I think at its peak, it was a weekly newspaper, and it took a lot of producing. So I was on the production side. I wasn't really doing any editorial because I couldn't read the part on the English page. I couldn't read the rest of it.
A lot of vernacular writing.
Yes, there was a lot of it, and basically it was one page per language, and each page had a language editor, with Mufuthu Nyana being the sort of overall editorial guru of the whole thing. I don't know quite how much he could read and how much he had to get read to him or explained to him. But I did all the technical side, seeing it through the printing, so on.
When did it start in Kulilaco? Or was that...
Umsebenzi failed. It collapsed because its press was seized by its creditors. That would have been about the 1938 period. When I joined the party, that Umsebenzi had already failed as press had been seized and there was nothing. So Nkululeko started about 1938 or 39 as only out, I think, monthly. And we used to go on a Sunday morning, a group of about 8 or 10 of us used to assemble in the party office. The stencils, I think, had already been typed. We spent the whole day running an electric duplicator, collating, stapling, and all the rest of it. An entire day's activity of a Sunday used to turn out the entire edition, which I think was 4 reams of paper, which would have made it about
2000.
Just under 2,000, 1,800 copies per month. Hilda, I think, used to do all the hand lettering on the covers.
People in those Sundays?
Michael Harmel, I don't know if he was one of those, but he was certainly doing some of the editorial and writing work. Archie Leverton, who...
Yeah.
Possibly Rowley Orenstein.
Dan Clumey?
No, I don't think so.
Wasn't Dan the... Who were the Africans?
I don't remember who actually worked on. In fact, I don't think any of them actually worked on the
production
side. They might have been writing. I don't know who was writing.
Well, they obviously were writing. You had all the vernacular.
Well, I don't know. He's early in Kulilaco. I don't know how much vernacular there was before it became printed. I'm not sure. I can't remember.
Who was it aimed at? Who did you? Was the audience perceived to be, and for what reason?
The working class, Don.
I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't know if anybody had an audience in mind. I mean, you're producing 1,800 copies of a monthly newspaper. In Johannesburg, you can't have a very big audience in mind. Presumably it was being sold at the night schools and in trade union branches and places like that. Couldn't have been very, very much.
And when you turned it into a printed
By that time, you see, the party had already begun to recover and it had quite a membership. I mean, quite a membership. It probably ran to 100 or 150 people in Johannesburg. And part of the unwritten constitution of the party at that time was that everybody in the party went out at least once a week and sold newspapers. And we used to spend every weekend either selling newspapers, selling New Age, selling The Guardian and selling Nkululeko.
Or speaking at meetings.
Or speaking at meetings, or both.
Meetings. Yes.
I mean, practically everybody was selling newspapers at one time or another each week. And That's how we got rid of the printed Inkululeko. I remember I used to sell it at that beer hall down the bottom end of Van Willig Street. I don't know if it's still there. My Mai, it was called. My Mai.
My Mai is still there.
It's still there. Is that not the bottom of Van Willig Street?
It's now got like a freeway over the top, but the people live under the freeway.
Well, there was a beer hall and I think a municipal compound or something down there, and I used to sell Inkululeko there every weekend, and everybody else in the party used to sell Inkululeko. Generally not door to door, generally in places like that, at bus stops or beer halls or something like that.
I find it fascinating that so much of the energy of an organisation goes around the media, the newspaper.
Teaching
was the other big activity. I suppose those were the two main activities. You used to have quite a lot of small public meeting, you know, in street corners on certain boxes and so on.
And then we had a lot of people who were members of trade unions and worked in the trade unions.
But I mean, on an office level, I think a tremendous part of the party's activity was in the propaganda field. I mean, producing leaflets just for handing out, you know, handbills to hand out, propaganda stuff. Producing newspapers, later on producing pamphlets, particularly during the war when we produced an awful lot of pamphlets. I don't know how many of them have survived in the archives. And that took quite a big part of the office activity. The branch activity was rather different. It was more a sort of door-to-door type of work. Our branches used to either sell New Age or The Guardian door-to-door, or they used to do in the townships, they'd be doing house-to-house work on local political problems, canvassing for an advisory board election or organising a demonstration or a deputation and so on.
But Guardian is running parallel to Nkululeko. How was the difference perceived?
Well,
was there any difference in the line, the political line?
I couldn't really say. The difference was perceived that the Guardian particularly was not the Communist Party's paper officially, and in fact I think at the time I'm talking about 38-39, it probably wasn't the party's paper even unofficially, it merely followed the party line. I think it was very much Betty Radford and George Sachs's private hobby horse, I think. I wasn't in Cape Town, so I don't know. And I don't know at what time it became the unofficial party property, I really don't know. Whereas Nkululeko from day one announced itself as the official organ of the, I don't know what, the Transvaal or the Johannesburg Communist Party. So to that extent they were different in their appeal to the population. One was talking as the organ of the Communist Party, and maybe there are differences in line. One would have to read it to see.
What is the circulation of Nkululeko at its height? Well, when was its height, I suppose, is a better question.
Its height was sometime during the war, like 43, 44, 45, I'm not sure exactly when it was being produced weekly, and something like 20,000 copies a week. Mm-hmm. So it never quite reached, I think, the circulation of the New Age at its peak. But the New Age was circulating nationally, whereas Nkululeko virtually was at Transvaal circulation. I mean, it hardly circulated in the other provinces because they didn't have the mix of languages. It wasn't an appropriate paper for anywhere else, really.
Who was your printer?
It was a distant relation of mine. I can't remember what his firm was called. He was a man called Clark. I mean, the fact he was a distant relation of mine was accidental. One of the directors of his firm was, strangely enough, a chap who became a Nationalist Party cabinet minister who, I think he's one of those blokes who got involved in the scandal was it? The
Salem?
No, the one with the propaganda department.
Oh yes, Muldergate.
I can't remember anyway. It was somebody who became a Nationalist Party MP, was one of the directors at that time. I don't think he was in the Nationalist Party, he was probably in the Afrikaner Party, this Herzog Party at that time. So it was just a purely commercial thing, and we became very big customers of theirs, and after a time I think we were probably their biggest customer. I mean, apart from our weekly newspaper, we were printing masses of handbills and printed pamphlets and all sorts of things. It was called Union Printers, was it called? I can't remember. Progress Printers or Union Printers? Union
Printers. Progress is Cape Town.
Progress was Cape Town. Yes, that was Lee Warden. Then it must have been something like Union Printing. But it was a totally commercial thing. I mean, they had no political interest in it.
Did you used to get harassed by the police at all?
Not much in the early days. We got harassed a bit at the time when we were opposing the war, we got harassed a bit, not so much by the police as by municipal officials,
yeah,
and
they
the post office.
They used to grab the supplies.
Yes, and local location superintendents and so on. They used to harass us quite a bit. But the police, really not really heavy-handed in those days, as long as you were peaceful, you know, as long as no actual violent demonstrations took place. So, I mean, it was quite often that we'd go and speak at a meeting over a weekend somewhere in a black location and get yourself arrested and your name taken and then thrown out of the police station an hour later when they've come senior blokes in. What the hell are you holding? Well, you know, what have they done? Maybe they broke a municipal bylaw by holding a meeting without a permit and you paid a £5 fine subsequently. And that sort of harassment, but nothing really heavy-handed or very little.
I suppose you would have gone into fairly concerted handbill and pamphlet circulation when the party was for joining up with the war effort. Would that have been when things started accelerating?
Well, I think there were two phases. I mean, there was first of all the phase we were against the war when people were starting to get arrested, like Dadu and Dawood Seedat in Natal, who was an Indian leader and so on. Some of our people being arrested under war emergency regulations and so on. And we ran big campaigns, propaganda campaigns, against these people's arrest and detention and so on. So there was a period when we were doing very intensive handbill distribution in the Transvaal, at any rate, about issues like that, not directly related to the whether we were for or against the war, but related to the way in which the authorities were clamping down on our people. And then the next big period was when we were supporting the war, when we began to produce propaganda really on a very wide scale. I mean, some of those pamphlets, I don't know if you've got copies of things like On the People and Away with Passes, but I remember the two big ones which we produced in about 1943 or 42.
I remember that because we used to go around shouting, On the Passes, Away with People.
We sold those in literally thousands and thousands of copies. I mean, they were being sold for a nominal or whatever it was, one penny, 2 pence, I don't remember now, but a nominal fee, but they were being sold and they really did go in thousands and thousands of copies. There was great political awareness in those days, even if they weren't all supporting us, they were interested to know what was being said.
Street corner distribution.
Street corner and all sorts of things. I mean, we did things like they had a war-sponsored, government-sponsored, enormous fete in Johannesburg called, I don't know, V for Victory Fete or something, in which they took over the whole of the Zoo Lake and other areas, and it was all part of a recruiting and patriotic drive thing. And we were our people were in amongst the crowds with bundles of these things selling On the People. Well, it sounded like it was part of the the V for Victory fete, and we saw thousands of them just sort of mingling with the crowd. So we were quite imaginative in the propaganda field in those days. You know, we were popular for one thing. You know, we weren't being heavily harassed. We felt we had support. And it was easy.
And we used to go out at night to the townships.
That was with handbills, just distributing free of charge. Yes, we used to do a lot of that in the townships at night.
Did you say sold those pamphlets? I mean, how did you raise funds for the party?
Well, the party always raised funds in basically in two ways. One was from its own members, and I mean, the membership subscriptions were by most organisational standards fairly substantial. You were expected to pay fairly heavily for the privilege. And then it had a large number, or quite a number, of sympathisers, people who used to give us monthly or periodic donations. People, a lot of them were Eastern European immigrants who'd come to South Africa, who remembered the party either in Germany during the rise of Hitler, that the party had been a sort of organisation they looked to as their shield in that period, or they were Eastern European refugees who remembered the party as being something that opposed the pogroms and the sort of racism of the Tsarist period and so on. So there were people of that sort who, for reasons of their own, would give us donations. So we used to go out and canvass them regularly, and that was the source of our funds.
When I stood for the city council, we collected quite large sums of money from very respectable people.
Mm. When did you stand for the city council?
I was elected in 1943, I suppose. I can't remember. I suppose I think I stood twice. At the beginning of 1943, they had some extra election, and then I stood again later on and got onto the council.
Mm.
But Michael Harmel and myself, we put up quite a number of candidates. We went and collected money from somebody who was at the stock exchange.
Mm.
And things like that. We collected. Mm. This was a man who so much disliked the person who was opposing one of the Communist Party candidates that he was prepared to give money. Well, mm. I mean, we didn't question people's motives.
So you went to the City Hall and you went to war?
I was in the army back when Hilda won her election. I think I was there when she lost. I mm-hmm. probably contributed to her losing.
Oh, rubbish.
I couldn't contribute to her winning it,
election. You were very excited when I got elected. I got a letter from you. I'm absolutely thrilled with it.
Right. Did you go up north?
Yes, I was in Italy.
Mm.
That was his first time he left South Africa.
First time I'd ever been out of the country, in fact.
Did you join the Springbok Legion?
Yes, I was in the Springbok Legion, and that's how I came eventually to be associated with Fighting Talk, because Fighting Talk...
Now we're coming on to the subject of your visit.
No, it's been the subject of my visit all along.
Well, just to come on to that, I joined the Springbok Legion while I was in the army, and when I came back, the Fighting Talk was already running. The Springbok Legion started fighting. It was their journal. It was their...
Yes. Where did it start? It started in Ethiopia,
I can't tell you where it started, because I wasn't in on the start of it. I mean, I wasn't... I can't claim to have been a founder of it or even a founder of the Springbok Legion, because at the time the Springbok Legion was founded, I was still working for the Communist Party. So I don't know where it started, but it started and ran quite successfully during the war. It had a number of fairly high-pressure publicists and journalists of different types working for it, particularly cartoonists. It had two of the top South African cartoonists.
What were they? I've seen some of the cartoons. They're terrific.
Vic Clapham was one of the really marvellous cartoonists, and the other was a chap called Abe Berry, who became probably the best-known political cartoonist in South Africa at that time. I think he was probably on one of the daily papers. Mm. I can't recall exactly his background.
Who was the other chap, Vic?
Vic Clapham. He was a very good artist.
Yes.
Unusual cartooning style.
Yes, he was a very good graphic artist. And then he went into the advertising industry and did very well.
Into which he dragged me later on.
I can't remember what happened.
I became a copywriter. Yeah. Yeah. That's my beginning of my journalistic career. A lot of people who write, who became journalists, started as copywriters. It's a very good training.
Yes, that's interesting.
And then I don't know who actually the journalistic side of the original Fighting Talk were, but I think it was probably a chap called Arthur Rudolph, who I think subsequently became a journalist on the Daily Mail or the something like that. He was a full-time journalist afterward. I don't know if he had been before. Now living in Britain somewhere, if he's still alive. I think he was probably the journalistic skills on the thing. Probably others. And then when he came back from the army, Cecil Williams, I think, became the editor of the paper.
What happened to Cecil Williams?
He died recently,
5-6 years ago in Britain.
Longer than that. Yeah.
He left South Africa in the 1960s, round about the same Peruvania period or a bit earlier. He was, I think, became the editor. He went to where he worked full-time for the Springbok Legion. I think he was doing the editorial side of it, together with others. Possibly Phyllis Altman. I don't know if she was associated, but she was a writer who worked for the Springbok Legion at the time.
Fred Collison?
Well, he was in Cape Town.
You see, this was a Johannesburg thing, and he would have been in Cape Town. I don't know that he was connected. Brian Bunting, possibly, because he spent a little time in Johannesburg before he emigrated to Cape Town. Migrated, I suppose. But I can't remember who ran it, but the thing was running quite successfully during the war, and then when the war ended, like the Springbok Legion, it began to tail off and droop a bit. I was dragged into the editorial side of it sometime after the war, when it was already on its decline. And finally, when the Springbok Legion more or less declined and the Congress of Democrats was about to be formed, I think the Springbok Legion decided it could no longer afford the paper, and it decided it was going to abolish it, and we formed an independent editorial board which then took over Fighting Talk, the name, and whatever remained of its circulation.
Who did you conceive of yourself as, that board that took it over?
Well, you know, I don't know that
Cod
we...
or...
No, I think it was probably prior to the formation of Cod.
It was a long time before Cod was formed.
It was a time when the Springbok Legion was in decline, so it would have been between 46, and I think Cod was formed about 52?
52?
Something like that, 52, after the...
During the Defiance campaign,
52, 53. So it was between 46 and 53. It was in decline. It was going to go out of existence. So some of us took it over. Most of us were, in fact, members of the Springbok Legion. But the Legion itself didn't want to carry on the paper for financial reasons. I know that Jack Hodgson, Cecil Williams, and I were still associated with it. And we began to draw in other people, writers or journalists or people who would help keep the thing going.
Why did you want to keep it going?
It was propaganda,
yes,
wasn't
I
it?
That's right. Well, I don't know. It was propaganda for a cause.
Do you
I
want
think
to
one's whole no thanks, one whole instinct is to
keep it alive.
To develop your propaganda regardless of who you're talking to or what you're talking about. I think propaganda's become sort of obsessional about propaganda, and this is what happened. I think we felt we were talking to some sort of a limited democratic constituency which didn't have a voice. I mean, I think we were talking particularly to the not to the black masses, we never saw it as that, but to the white population, the intelligentsia, perhaps amongst the coloured and Indians, you know, the people, the literate and literary people who would read a sort of quasi-literary political magazine of sorts. So we felt we had some sort of a constituency that was worth talking to and trying to persuade of our line, and also as a sort of opposition to the nationalist propaganda, which was very powerful at that time and very effective in winning over ex-servicemen and people who formerly had been anti-nationalist and beginning to change sides. So we gathered together this independent board and we ran the thing for a time, and then when the Congress of Democrats was formed, I think we formally, as far as I recall, formally or informally, transferred the Fighting Talk to a joint board, which the bulk of the people were probably COD people.
Mm. Those people on the interim committee, were they mainly party people?
Probably, you know, I wouldn't like to, I can't recall who they all were. I mean, I remember Jack Hodgson and Cecil Williams. I can't remember who the others were in the interim period. It was a shifting sort of thing. And then finally, one way or another, we drew Ruth, well, this was after it had ceased being the Springbok Legion, and it's a sort of association with the Legion had been formally discontinued. Ruth got drawn into the thing, Ruth First, and gradually it began to change its character, and people outside of the party and the Springbok Legion circles began to get drawn in, writers, and particularly writers, people like Dennis Brutus and Alex Laguma, A.S. Hutchinson.
Alfred Hutchinson,
who was one of the most talented writers we had around.
Who was he?
Hello, Ryan.
Thanks, we've got milk and everything. We just the paper.
Alfred Hutchinson was a. He was an African in Johannesburg.
Saturday morning till tomorrow.
He was a really marvellous writer, I mean, a literary man with a great imagination, a real talent in my view, one of the most talented people we produced.
That's very
stupid. He wrote articles and so on, some of which you'll find in Fighting Talk, which I think most of which were really marvellous pieces of literary pieces.
You're talking about Hutch?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then he left South Africa, quite early, I suppose around about 1958 or 60, and he wrote a book about his departure.
The Road to Ghana, wasn't it called?
The Road to something, I think
the Road to
Ghana.
Ghana,
which is, what he did was he he smuggled himself out because he had no travel papers and he had no documents. In those days, Africans couldn't get passports. I mean, it was almost an impossibility. He got on a train with migrant miners who were going back to Malawi or Tanzania or somewhere. He dressed himself up as a miner. And he wrote the story of his travel across Africa in this train with miners, migrant miners, being packed into sort of cattle truck conditions. And
it was a very good book.
Marvellous book.
Yes.
This was really a literary talent, this man.
Yeah.
But after that, he didn't write anymore.
Yeah, he came to Britain and he took the stuff.
I suppose he was drinking, I don't know what, but... He just couldn't get his life together.
Yeah, lots of people had that.
Yeah, well, he lost his roots. I mean, basically, because he was a township lad from Johannesburg, and his roots were there, and he really had this marvellous literary ability and feeling for what was going on in the township. And he came to Britain, and I think he was way out of his depth. There wasn't even at that time a really organised South African exile community in Britain, because
it was before the big
exile population started arriving. So he was out on a limb and lost, and he was a bit of a, like many writers of that generation, of the sort of literary generation of the early 1960s. He drank a lot and he didn't, a bit rootless.
Mm-hmm.
He married a British girl eventually here, but he never wrote anything worth talking about. And then he died quite young. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. I don't know what, in his middle 40s.
It was a really sad story, because there was the talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You said that when Ruth became the editor and more people were drawn in, it changed character a bit. Was that because, in line with the development of the Congress of Democrats and the Congress Alliance, or what would have...
Well, I think the changing of the line as far as the Congress movement was concerned was a sort of continuous process. It started with the Springbok Legion, which was already moving closer to the liberation movement at the time of its decline. And that continued, and from the time of the Congress of Democrats being formed, it carried on. But what Ruth did was she enlarged its circle from whom it drew its writers. So because she had journalistic and other contacts with people that we didn't have, and so she drew in people who were writers. Like, for instance, I remember in Cape Town there was a man called Richard Reeve, who was another very good
He's written a number of books, actually.
He was drawn in. He used to write. I mean, he didn't participate on the editorial side. Dennis Brutus began to take part as part of the editorial board. And so the circle enlarged in a sort of political, but also a very much
and more
literary.
More intellectual
and literary direction. And that was Ruth's influence very largely, I think. We were rather more narrowly political, the original people.
Well, we were more propagandists.
Yes,
and this, this became, well, it's not wasn't an intellectual journal, but it veered a little bit that way.
Political and cultural.
Yes, that's right.
I think the cultural side was this sort of period when Ruth was running it, more than the period previously where we had little contact with cultural people.
Did the committee, the board, controlling fine, or what is the relationship between the board and the editor, and who was that board?
Well, the editor was really the person who proposed, let me put it, the board actually was a real editorial board. It comprised about five or six people. It was a fairly movable board, of whom I was one of probably the longest continuous thing, because I'd started from the Springbok Legion. I went right through to the time when the paper was banned, so I had the longest continuous association with it. Cecil Williams, Dennis Brutus at some time, Ruth for quite a considerable time. A man called Paul Joseph, who used to sit on the editorial board, he's now living in Britain.
Lives in Melville.
Indian from the Transvaal, who really was our circulation manager. He sat on the board as not so much on the editorial side as far as his contribution was on the circulation.
He's an Indian
from the Transvaal. Very active, energetic in that sort of thing, in distribution, in organising sales, but not on the editorial side, although he sat on the board. I can't think who else was on the board. But it varied slightly from time to time.
What did it do, that board? Hmm? What did the board do?
The board decided in advance what sort of articles it was going to try and get, and who it was going to try and get to write them for the next issue, what sort of topics it felt had to be dealt with, what the editorial would deal with, that sort of thing.
So it's fairly democratic editorial policy. It wasn't all the editor decided.
Well, except that the meeting would take, I don't know how often, but in between, obviously, finally the editor had to say, did we cut this piece out or did we put it in? Was it good enough or did we send it back to the author and say, sorry, we... You know, that finally rested with the editor. It wasn't that every article was read by the whole committee, but the contents were planned and supervised, and then we'd look at the last issue and criticise it and say, this was bad and that should have been done a different way and we'd better get a reply to this article and so on. So it was that sort of a board. It was a supervisory board more than anything, and the editor more or less edited.
She paid...
No, nobody was paid. The whole thing, no writers were paid, nobody was paid. I mean, the thing was a totally voluntary operation.
Do you remember its circulation?
No, not really. I would guess it was something in a few thousand, you know, but I'm just guessing, really. I've got no memory of it at all.
To get paid for writing, huh? Didn't happen.
I have written, I think I must be the most prolific writer in the whole history of South African politics, and I've never earned a single penny from anything I've ever written, I can tell you that.
Hilda, why did you decide to stand for council?
I didn't decide, the party decided. They're going to put people up.
Who did you beat when you got in?
A whole lot of people, about three or four other candidates. Including one standing for the Labour Party, Liebman, Dr. Liebman, who had been the sitting councillor. And I can't remember who the others... Oh, there was a rate payer. It was at a time when the Johannesburg City Council had not had openly proclaimed political parties. There was an organisation called the Ratepayers Association, which was basically, the smuts. Sort of wing, and the Nationalist Party at that stage came in and put up candidates as a party, and the Labour Party put up candidates, but the council itself was in a state of sort of flux. We had a Eastern European friend I'm always quoting him, who said Hilda got elected to the Johannesburg City Council by a series of coincidences surmounted by a fluke. And I think this was one of the coincidences, that the council itself was not very strongly organised, and the relationships between the political groupings was sort of being changing at that time. It was at the height of the Soviet resistance.
Stalingrad, wasn't it?
1943, yes. Yeah. I came in on a wave of pro-Soviet feeling, if you can believe it, among the white population. That was one of the coincidences, series of coincidences.
Russia was busy winning the war for
that's
the
right, for the yes, mm-hmm. yes. And there were various other things, factors. The party decided to put up candidates in a number of constituencies, and I just happened to be one of those, presumably. Molly Fisher was one of them. Bram Fisher's wife stood in Bramfontein. I don't remember. Michael Harmore was standing as one candidate in one constituency.